It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's January the 10th, 1977, and this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 251. I get a little upset in preparation of the programs each week because there's so much news to share with you, and I had approximately 52 subjects that would cover the entire year right now that I would like to talk about because they're current and simultaneous, but we'll take them slowly and one at a time and do the best we can each week. The bulk of the program today is going to be talking about a new book by Howard Bloom called Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America, and overlay it with the article that I wrote for Paul Krasner and The Realist in 1972, in the summer of 72, called Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And I'm going to talk about the Nixon links to Nazis in America, and the theme of what seems to be the overriding theme of every Dialogue Conspiracy is the Fourth Reich, which has been developing since the end of World War II, and its roots were very deep into the law office of Richard Nixon. And then, of course, he appointed Gerald Ford on the Warren Commission, and my interest in Nazis became very curious at the time I was studying the John Kennedy assassination and cross-filing the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings, because the friends of Lee Harvey Oswald were Nazis, oil engineers and Nazis, and so that my interest in Nazis and the Hughes Corporation became more intense through the years, and now this new book has come out, which is dynamite, and I do want to spend most of the program on that. But I did want to bring up each week a few comments on the Howard Hughes cases, which are pending in court, because they are the umbrella cloak by which the Nazis came to America through the Hughes Organization, the aerospace contracts, and also because Howard Hughes had selected Richard Nixon as his particular representative for this operation. I made these allegations for the last 4 years when I first published that item in my Realist article, and now the names and places of the agents is being confirmed in a new book that came out and in new articles. In Houston, Texas, there's a battle regarding the Howard Hughes case because the attorney general there says that Howard Hughes' legal residence was in Texas, and for tax reasons and for other investigative reasons, he's forcing the Summa Corporation to produce some papers on the condition of Howard Hughes, his mental state, the last 10 years particularly. Did he have a free will from the time he left there to decide what place he wanted to be in? And there's a new article out by Phil Henever from the Houston Post. It isn't carried in the Associated Press, United Press again, that the Howard Hughes Corporation, the Summa Corporation, refuses to turn over any documents on Howard Hughes, on his medical condition, or anything about Howard Hughes's mental state. The Attorney General there has asked for these things. The Summa Corporation will not turn them over, and they claim that they don't have to, that they are, again, beyond the law, it seems, that they will not turn over any evidence about the Summa Corporation that they need in Houston, Texas, to continue the pursuit to have the case handled there. They also called a man to testify, Mr. Waldron, who has used the Howard Hughes signature for many, many years. There have been forgeries of Howard Hughes, and Hughes has never signed documents, really have not been verified since the late 50s, and again carried in the Houston Post. Mr. Waldron finally, he got a subpoena, and he was hiding away and didn't want to serve. He wouldn't receive the subpoena. He finally was served with one that he dropped, his hands dropped it, and he appeared willingly in court and claims that just a few months prior to Howard Hughes' death, that he saw Howard Hughes sign a $28 million loan in the Texas Commerce Bank, that Howard Hughes asked for $28 million just prior to his death. Now, this is totally inconsistent with the several aides that worked for Hughes. Hughes was incoherent at that time. He's been drugged and literally a vegetable, And the question is, who received the $33.25 million? And Johnny Meyer in Vancouver has evidence that this request for the money was forged and written by an aide of Mr. Hughes named Mr. Holmes. So we're talking about $33 million, $33.25 million that was taken from the Hughes organization when Hughes was literally a vegetable, skin and bones, and totally out of his mind. And the question is, where did the money go? Who signed the name? And Mr. Waldron did go to court. As I say, he dropped a subpoena that touched the floor and said there's some things he wouldn't answer. But they're trying to find out how this loan was procured. And Johnny Meyer is asking Mr. Holmes to testify also because he has a memo that Howard Hughes didn't sign for the loan. Also, some mortal enemies of Howard Hughes, all part of the Hughes organization at one time, have to appear in Reno. This is a UPI story, but it isn't in our local papers, the New York Times or Washington Post. It has to do with that stock manipulation of Air West, and the defendants are interesting. There's David Charney, a Hughes aide, and Chester Davis, the chief counsel for the Summa Corporation, the Hughes Corporation, and Robert Mayhew. Robert Mayhew was fired in 1970 when this person that I say was not Howard Hughes, this double, was flown to the Bahamas. And Chester Davis replaced him and became part of the Summa Corporation. And these three men were working together for Howard Hughes at the time that there was stock fraud and conspiracy and wire fraud in connection with the purchase of Air West Airlines. So the drama taking place in Reno, Nevada is going to be very interesting. They have been asked to appear for an arraignment. The date will be January 14th. That's 4 days from now. So if we could get a live view of these men, Chester Davis and Robert Mayhew, facing each other, it would be interesting. The person who was in the hotel room at Las Vegas, who sent a memo out desperately to Mayhew, get the Lockheed people to send a plane, get me out of the clutches of the Summa Corporation, and it could have been a double wind to escape. There was a desperate letter, drop Chester Davis and get me out of here. And before anything could be done to get this body out of the hotel, and that body was under the care of doctors and oxygen and a hemoglobin of 4 and literally a vegetable at that stage, trying to get out of Las Vegas before Robert Mayhew could get in and break through the doors, if he could have at all, Chester Davis and Intertel and a group of former FBI and CIA men swept Hughes to the Bahamas. So in the courtroom will be Chester Davis and Robert Mayhew, and I'm sure that that is the stuff that will make books and plays and movies for years to come. But that drama is unfolding, and unfortunately the people in this country are not getting wire service news on that. And one brief remark, today's paper had an article, the CIA link to the Cuban pig virus reported, and it says that the CIA did make swine flu, that they had killed 500,000 pigs to starve off the people in Cuba, and that the Central Intelligence Agency has been making swine flu vaccine as a weapon against our so-called enemies overseas. And of course, you know, if they have that swine flu, they can make it at home. We mentioned swine flu last year. Follow that, but now the CIA is making it. The big item on this story is that an agent involved in handling the swine flu tells how they passed it to Cuba to kill the cattle. And what I said was that eventually, if we keep up with the Legionnaire disease and the swine flu and follow it closely enough, someone inside those agencies and inside the Hughes Corporation is going to come forward and they're going to say, yes, the CIA makes swine flu. Yes, it put a toxic poison in the air conditioning ducts where the Legionnaire people died. Yes, Howard Hughes was buried, and that's Vance Cooper buried in Houston, Texas. He will take someone from the inside. In the meanwhile, careful researchers in the scientific and social and political fields have to keep delving into those matters. I also want to bring you up weekly to the congressional hearings in Washington to open up the investigation of Martin Luther King's murder and John Kennedy's murder. I don't have the news yet today. The vote of Congress was to take place today on whether to give the committee $6 million. I see that the election for this last year cost $72 million to elect a president of the United States, but the Congress doesn't have $6 million to find out who's killing our presidents or our civil rights leaders. The House Judiciary Subcommittee chairman a congressman from California, Don Edwards, is blasting that committee back there. I'm glad to see that somebody else is blasting it for reasons not unlike my objections to it. Representative Edwards claims that that committee, this is a quote, plans to secretly record the remarks of potential witnesses with the use of hidden body transmitters and then subject the responses to psychological stress evaluation. Such procedures are, to say the least, totally inappropriate for use by a congressional committee. They plan to use hidden recording devices and stress evaluation that would constitute an intentional invasion of the most fundamental rights of Americans, and I believe the techniques by that committee would be wrong for Congress to use them. Congressman Edwards said, and I agree, that it is immoral and it's illegal. And I think those of you that listen every week to Dialogue Conspiracy know that I have absolutely no trust or confidence in the men that are opening it up or the way they're going about it. The committee in Washington has asked for $6.5 million for the first year budget. In that budget, they have $4,400 for two hidden microphones and recording devices, $8,000 for two stress evaluators, $2,800 for polygraph machines, another $120,000 for four technicians to read the polygraph psychological stress evaluation unit. Now, the trouble with the Warren Commission was that the FBI and the CIA investigated the killing of John Kennedy, and yet those were the very persons, according to my 13 years research, who killed John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And yet they want to allocate thousands of dollars for equipment for the same people to read it and use it who were part of the assassination plan. A researcher named George O'Toole used this evaluation team. He was formerly with the CIA. He works with Bernard Fensterwald of the CIA. And they want to get this fancy equipment that only the FBI and the CIA make and read, and therefore they can get guilty witnesses like Mrs. Ruth Payne, who was involved in the Kennedy assassination, and placed Lee Harvey Oswald in the Texas School Book Depository, and they can look at the stress evaluator, which is what George O'Toole did, and said Ruth Payne was telling the truth when she was lying through her teeth. Congressman Edwards said, we want to make sure that that committee procedures complies with the Constitution of the United States. He says they are treading on the constitutional rights of the citizens of this country, and his objections, he said, will make this committee similar to the House Un-American Activities that Richard Nixon ran and Joseph McCarthy ran, and then all the researchers that have done important work on the John Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassination, will be discredited for being identical to the McCarthy era and will all be thrown down the drain because our techniques are bad. So I want the record clear that I don't approve of them or the way they're going about their techniques. This idea to use a stress evaluator and these secret hidden microphones has to be in conjunction with the approval of Richard Sprague, the chief counsel of this committee. And don't forget, he worked with one of the chief lawyers of the Warren Commission, Mr. Arlene Specter, in Philadelphia for 10 years. They also plan a budget for $3.6 million in salaries for a staff of 170 persons, including 50 investigators. Now, can you imagine anything so absolutely asinine and stupid? $3.6 million for a staff of 170 people and 50 investigators, when at least 50 investigators around the United States, myself included, have done work on this for 10 or 13 years, and they're not going to use our work. They want $1.7 million for domestic travel. They want $180,000 for international travel. They've already gone down to Mexico and spent money down there when looking for 13-year-old dry leads of somebody Oswald knew or spoke to at the Cuban embassy, if it was even Oswald there, because there was somebody using his name who was photographed there that wasn't Oswald. And they want $425,000 for telephone calls when most of the researchers I know, including myself, are calling them at our own expense. They've also hired two New York City cops that were with the Red Squad in New York City, an organization that should itself be investigated as members of the Warren Commission investigation the second time around. And the whole committee is suspect for many reasons we've gone over on the program. There's a problem now. A gentleman in Texas claims, his name is Richard Lester, that 2 years ago he found a bullet behind the railroad station, and he thinks that it was shot November 22nd, 1963. The FBI said, give us the bullet. We want to test it to Oswald's rifle. The committee said, no, the FBI is under investigation, so you don't have the right to it. So they're having fights back there, similar to Representative Pike's committee investigating the CIA last year that took 6 months and used up the salary and didn't do any investigations. They got embroiled in fights, and I don't even think that they need this bullet that was 2 years old. You see, what they'll do is they'll bring in FBI papers, new bullets, new evidence, and instead of using the evidence that researchers have accumulated that points to a high-level government conspiracy that we've done 13 years work with, they don't want to touch that. They bring in a new memo, a new document, a new person who says Oswald's voice was recorded at the embassy. They shouldn't touch the new evidence till every researcher has been allowed to tell what they did, present their bibliography, their conclusions, give them some leads, and then send the team out to it. But they're bringing in a whole team of new people who belong to police departments all their lives, who never believed there was a conspiracy in the first place, and they're going to start from scratch, and they're going to take a few leads, and I think it's a disaster. I don't know what the budget will be voted, but if it were $30 million in 10 years, I doubt that the way they're going about it, they would find it in 10 years, even though the truth is found in many private libraries around the country. Well, now to this wonderful book. This book just came out last week. Harold Bloom, he was on national television, Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America. He has a sentence here about Richard Nixon, Herbert Hoover, a man named Mr. Malaxa, and Bishop Trivia. And he said, why did all those gonifs happen to get together? Gonif is a Hebrew word for a thief. How did they happen to get together? And then he realized and reconstructed the role of Richard Nixon, Herbert Hoover, Mr. Malaxa, and Bishop Trivia, and that realized that they were beginning the Fourth Reich when they all melted together in the early 50s and in the 40s, as a matter of fact, that when World War II was over, that these people teamed together to keep Hitler's wishes alive. And this is the allegation in this book, and this is what my research has been pointing to, unfortunately, all along. Now, in the White House tapes that Nixon is fighting to conceal, he talks about keeping Julie Nixon away from the art galleries because they're run by Jews. He didn't want her there with the Jews. But there was more to the White House tapes that aren't out yet. Alexander Cockburn from the Village Voice in New York City said that there were highly personal comments that included flecks of anti-Semitism. Now, anti-Semitism being heard from Richard Nixon's lips isn't as important because he's only a puppet and a figure as it is to what Richard Nixon does or what he represents. And in my first published article in The Realist, it was in August 1972. I completed it 4 weeks after the arrest at Watergate, but I had been working on the Nixon story, and when they were arrested, the men were arrested at Watergate Hotel, the Nixon story that I was working for, how Nixon actually got into power, fit right to the men at Watergate, and that is how I could break that first story of the links of Richard Nixon to the burglary at the Watergate Hotel. What I said in The Realist in 1972, and I say it again for you today in case you don't have that article and you don't remember it or didn't know that I wrote it, briefly I said Richard Nixon, I'll read it to you from there and then parts from this book that overlap. I said Richard Nixon came to power as a carefully planned person, that it was a strategy. I said the rise of Adolf Hitler and fascism in Germany was carefully planned. It began with the illegal rearmament of the covert army after World War I, the breaking of the Versailles Treaty. In order to get Hitler to power, they had over 400 political assassinations and a perversion of the law courts and the Supreme Court in Germany. The rise of Richard Nixon in the United States was carefully planned. We used the same illegal attitude that they did after World War I in Germany and began bringing secret armies into the United States. And these armies were involved in the killing of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. Richard Nixon, the front man and leader of this illegal government, bringing these Nazis here, was mistaken by many intellectuals as being a comical person. And yet, on January the 20th, 1969, he was inaugurated president of the United States. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of the State from 1953 to 59, the years that Richard Nixon was Vice President, and he had tremendous power and influence over the military and industrial. I quoted a statement by President Eisenhower, Alan Dulles, that President Eisenhower had surrendered all his power to me. And Alan Dulles' brother, he was Secretary of the State, he had a brother named John Foster Dulles, had a brother named Alan. John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State. And Alan Dulles headed what was our Office of Strategic Service that became known as the CIA. OSS remained in that form while Alan Dulles was over in Switzerland. And by 1942, he realized that there, in the event that Hitler lost World War II to the Russians, that the Germans would be moved to this country. So he moved to Switzerland to set up the arrangement for Nazi scientists and arms experts to come to America. And from 1945 to 1952, under an operation called Project Paperclip, 642 alien Nazis and their families came to the United States. They were ammunition makers, war experts that helped Adolf Hitler get the war machine going from the end of World War I, and they were brought to the United States. And the Nazi Empire was sent to Egypt, Australia, and Sweden, and Spain, and to the United States. The combined forces of Reinhard Gehlen, I've mentioned his name on KLRB many times, he was the head of Adolf Hitler's Eastern Division and set up his entire spy system. He took our OSS with Alan Dulles and formed the CIA, so that the CIA that you read about is an exact duplicate of the Nazi war machine and intelligence system. At this time, Richard Nixon, I put in the article, enter Richard Nixon. Nixon was working in the Navy Bureau of Aeronautics. He was working with aircraft firms such as Bell and Glenn Martin while he was still in the Navy. He was a commander in the Navy, and he was working at 50 Church Street in New York City, the Bureau of Aeronautics. And in 1945, the year that Richard Nixon was in New York City, was the exact time that these Nazis were brought into the United States, and they stayed at a huge medieval castle owned by Jay Gould, a 160-acre estate in Long Island. And Richard Nixon was working in the Navy at the time the Navy's Office of Research and Invention brought these Nazis here. By 1945, the armed services had accepted the Nazis into our colleges, into our Defense Department. They went into space industries, warfare hardware. They moved to the South, the Southwest, California, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, and so forth. Richard Nixon was serving in the Navy at this time when he got a telephone call from a man named Herman Perry. This was the article that I wrote in 1972. Perry said, "Are you a Republican? Are you available? You will run against Jerry Voorhees in California." And Richard Nixon came out to California where he met Howard Hughes in the bungalow of the Beverly Hills Hotel. Herman Perry at that time was vice president of Bank of America. Richard Nixon was fairly unknown. His law office before he went into Navy intelligence was in Whittier, California. Richard Nixon then went on to the House of Representatives where he began to prosecute Alger Hiss in the Senate as he was a senator. He became famous through his work in the House on Americans activity, then became a senator, then a vice president, then be president of the United States after John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were killed. And in my article, I mentioned the name of a man, Isaac Don Levine, who worked with Marina Oswald, getting a communist story out of Marina after Lee Harvey Oswald was dead. And Isaac Don Levine worked with Richard Nixon to help smear Alger Hiss. He worked along with Whitaker Chambers and took him, Chambers was reluctant, took him to the hearings at the time that we made Richard Nixon famous, the House Un-American Activities, that famous Alger Hiss case. Now that is the story I wrote in The Realist about Richard Nixon, how he came to fame, and out comes Mr. Bloom's book. It just came out this last week, Howard Bloom, and there's a chapter, two chapters, in addition to all the massive information I have of Richard Nixon and Nazis. And I want to read you a little bit about Howard Bloom's book and tell you about it because he has the section of Nixon and the Nazis. He talks about a Bishop Trifia who was brought to the White House. He spoke for Radio Free Europe. He talked about Nazis and the glory of the killing of the Jews. He was a friend of J. Edgar Hoover's. He bragged on Radio Free Europe that J. Edgar Hoover was his friend. At the time that J. Edgar Hoover was vice president of Interpol, which was made up of members of the Gestapo, and Richard Nixon had Bishop Trifiet before the U.S. Senate, May the 11th, 1955, to open up the prayers. Well, Bishop Trifiet was identified as early as 1941 as the commander of the Iron Guard Corps. He was a radical, extreme, devout Nazi, and he fought in Romania. He belonged to this secret organization called the Iron Guard Corps, which then melded with Hitler when Hitler went into Romania. The Iron Guard Corps became one. And the source of the guns and tanks for the Iron Corps were supplied by a man named Nicolae Malaxa, M-A-L-A-X-A. This was in Romania in 1941. Mr. Malaxa, he was the wealthiest man in Romania, if not all of Eastern Europe. And he manufactured munitions and artillery factories and controlled the steel and rubber in Romania and Eastern Europe. And Malaxa supplied the Iron Guard and the Nazis, and they in turn supplied ammunition also for the extermination camps. Malaxa was a businessman. He was involved in Romanian politics. He conspired, as I say, both with the Nazis and the Iron Guard. And in 1936, he'd gone to Berlin, where he met with Reich Marshal Hermann Göring. You know who Göring is, Hitler's right-hand man. Malaxa was manufacturing the arms, the ammunition, the weapons for all of Eastern Europe in conjunction with Hitler and Hitler's right-hand man, Hermann Göring. And he got so close to Hermann Göring that his business partner became Albert Göring, the brother of Hermann Göring, Hitler's right-hand man. And he continued making weapons through the war. Nicholas Malaxa supplied the police with arms and all the Nazis in Eastern Europe as long as he could. And when the Nazis were defeated, he made friends in Romania and Eastern Europe towards the end of the war with, who would you guess, a Grady McClossin, his name is, who was the head of the American OSS. That was the division that Alan Dulles was working with in Switzerland, and Mr. Malaxa met up with the officer of the Strategic Services who came into Romania at the time, and Malaxa began to be employed there working for the OSS, and then they arranged his trip to the United States, and the immigration officials paid his way to the United States, where Mr. Malaxa, the man supplying the arms and weapons, the business partner of Mr. Hermann Göring and his younger brother was the Albert Göring, came to the United States. And he received in the United States $2,460,000 for reparations for his steel company. After he lost it when the Russians took over, he received $2,460,000. That's a nice little nest egg to settle in the United States. But where do you think Mr. Malaxa settled? He arrived in the United States in September 29, 1946, about 6 months after Richard Nixon had been selected by this group from Whittier to represent them in the House of Representatives. His first stop was New York City, where he claimed millions of dollars, which he said were deposited for him before the war in the Chase National Bank, which was one of his corporations. He had already, besides the reparations of $2,460,000 from the U.S. government, the OSS, he also had some money at Chase First National Bank in New York City, Chase National Bank, which is owned by the Rockefellers, and came to California. The funds were kept for him by a John Field, the Treasury Department, all during the war. This was our arch enemy during the war. And a provision was made for Malaxa to come to the United States through the Immigration Commission. The office of Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, the law firm, the brother of the new head of our CIA that was working with the Nazis, the law office that represented not only the Rockefeller family, the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, also represented I.G. Farben and Nazis before and during the war. These people signed the papers and the approval of Malaxa. They personally testified for Malaxa's behalf to come to the United States for the Congressional Subcommittee on Immigration. So we have this wealthy man from Eastern Europe manufacturing arms and gunpowder, receiving several million dollars in reparations, several million dollars of cash from the Rockefeller Chase banks in New York City and then getting a immigration permission from the Department of Immigration from John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles, and the medium by which he got here was the notorious OSS. And where did Mr. Meloxis settle? He moved to California. What city did he move in? Whittier, California. Who comes from Whittier, California? Richard Nixon. So he moved right in there, and he opened a company which became a dummy front called Western Tube Corporation. And he claimed that he was making tubes for oil refining. And there's no evidence, according to this book, that it actually was the source of his making these tubes. And Mr. Meloxa, at the height of the Korean War in May 1951, was working at the Western Tube Corporation in California. He gave his address there as 607 the Bank of America building in Whittier, California. In case we're not familiar with it, that was the law address of Bewley, Krupp, and Richard Nixon, the law office. Mr. Meloxa picked up his few million dollars in New York City, his couple million dollars of reparations in addition. He stops in New York for a while to get his cash. He comes to Whittier, California, to the law office of Richard Nixon, and opens up a dummy front called Western Tube. And the excuse for keeping him here during the Korean War was that he was very valuable to the war effort, that he was already making tubes for the Korean War, and that his expertise was important for the war in Korea. Now, Thomas Bewley, who was Nixon's longtime friend and law partner, the law office of Bewley and Nixon, Bewley, Krupp, and Nixon. Mr. Bewley, Nixon's law partner, was the secretary of Western Tube, the dummy front for one of the most notorious, dangerous Nazis in the entire world, whose partner in Europe in crime was Goering's brother. His law partner was the secretary of Western Tube. And then, to add on to this little story, and maybe I'll have to repeat it to get the impact of this thing, Herman Perry, vice president of the Bank of America, the very first man that picked up the phone and said to Richard Nixon, when he was back in Long Island bringing the Nazis to America for Navy intelligence and brought him to California for the Howard Hughes and aerospace industries to run as a member of the House of Representatives against Jerry Furey, Herman Perry, who I wrote about as being vice president of American Bank of America, and his office, the law business of Richard Nixon, is in the Bank of America building. He turns out to be, Herman Perry, the vice president of the same tube company, the dummy front that Mr. Meloxi formed with his millions of dollars when he came here from Nazi Germany. So that Richard Nixon's law partners and was a law partner, was a member of the board of directors of this dummy front of a Nazi corporation, and the same Herman Perry, vice president of the Bank of America, was also in as part of the Western Tube. And to make matters worse, Mr. Meloxi went from Whittier, California with his millions of dollars and went down to Argentina, and he was there at the exact same time when another family that I'm familiar with, the Alexander Zeiger family, was there. Herman Wiesenthal, the known Nazi hunter who lived in Europe for so many years, who's in this country looking for Nazis, was searching for Nazis. And I wrote to him, I think as early as 1965 or 69, and said, check out Alexander Zeiger. I believe he's a Nazi from Argentina who's running the Minsk radio factory where Lee Harvey Oswald is. It was in Minsk in Russia. I think he got in under the guise of being a Jew or a Soviet sympathizer, but he's the only person in contact with Lee Harvey Oswald who isn't a known Nazi from World War II. And Zeiger's family were the ones that Allen Dulles was arranging to bring back to Argentina after John Kennedy was killed. I've mentioned that on the air, that I have a memo that part of the working papers of the Warren Commission, that it was brought up that Allen Dulles bring Isaac Don Levine as the expertise. He was to be the middleman, or rather Isaac Don Levine, Richard Nixon's friend and Whitaker Chambers' friend, and also the friend of Mr. Meloxa, was to arrange to bring the Zeiger's daughters back to Argentina after the Kennedy assassination. The CIA would do it. So there was a CIA link always to the Minsk radio factory. Well, May 17th, 1951, the Western Tube Corporation filed for certificate of necessity to give them priority for its material and personnel for the war in Asia. And they requested top priority. They said that Nikolai Meloxi, on grounds that he was indispensable to the operation of that war in Asia, that he be allowed to stay in this country and that Western tubes stay there. And then both applications to continue making material for the war in Asia for his staying in this country, those applications were signed by Senator Nixon. In the meanwhile, Western Tube had the same address in Whittier, California, as Nixon's law office. And Mr. Perry, who was the backer or the overt backer behind Richard Nixon, a board of directors of the Meloxi, was signing the papers also. They were all for Mr. Meloxi. So Nixon had called the Immigration Naturalization Service to plead for the entry into the United States of Mr. Meloxi, and he was allowed to stay. After Western Tube was allowed in the United States, and it, as I say, it was a dummy front that could be formed with millions of dollars, it was nothing but a dummy front. This book goes on to say there was no reason to create Western Tube. The important thing is that Mr. Meloxi could go to Chase Bank and get $2 million and set up an office in Whittier, then go to Argentina and pay other Nazis that were out, or pay Mr. Zeiger's way back to the Mintz radio factory where Lee Harvey Oswald was to arrive with $2 million, and the going rate is pretty low down in Argentina for labor, or paying these agencies, you know, on the world market. He could keep distributing and making money to former Nazis to support them in doing the work that they were doing to keep the Fourth Reich going. Meloxi went down to Argentina to visit with Juan Perón. He met in Buenos Aires with another man named Otto Skorinsky. That's the famous Nazi parachutist who rescued Mussolini in 1943, and it was named as part of the Odessa later. They tried to deport Meloxi in 1958, but of course Richard Nixon stepped in again. It was his old buddy. He used his address. He simply let the U.S. Attorney General William Rogers appeal, and they let him in the USA, and he died 10 years after he got back from Argentina. Meloxi is now dead. He can't be deported. But according to my time schedule, he died just at the time that Richard Nixon would have been elected for president, and after he defeated, there was no election in 68. Robert Kennedy was killed. I can't say he defeated Hubert Humphrey. He just stepped over the two Kennedys and became president of the United States. I think the use of Nixon and his office and his standing by this man and Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles signing the immigration papers, Allen Dulles introducing him to the OSS in Europe while he's bringing the Nazis, and Richard Nixon in Navy intelligence the time the Nazis came here, the use of the Rockefeller Bank for the money that was waiting for this man, the Secretary of State signing the papers, and also another man important to Richard Nixon's career was right behind him when he wanted special favors in this country. His name was Adolph Berle, and he was the Undersecretary of the State. Adolph Berle personally testified on Meloxi's behalf before the Congressional Subcommittee on Immigration. Now, Adolph Berle is not detached from Richard Nixon in any sense. As I say, if you get the book Friendship and Fratricide, the story of Whitaker Chambers and Alger Hiss, that tragedy, and the thing that made Richard Nixon famous as a communist hunter, you find that what we had in the United States was exactly the way Hitler came to power, taking people that were public servants, blaming them for being communists, and the same agents were now working in this country that had worked so successfully to get Hitler in power in the first place. In Friendship and Fratricide, Meyer Zelig's book, he talks about how Whitaker Chambers came forward and wanted or was used as an instrument to say that Alger Hiss was a communist. And the important thing is that Alger Hiss was a devout anti-communist. The record shows that he did not want to send money. Quotations here, he did not want to send money to Germany. He did not want to send arms to Germany. All the years that Germany was rearming, he was exposing them. And in the Senate hearings, he was a violent anti-Nazi. And also, Alger Hiss did not support the Berlin Soviet, the Stalin-Hitler Pact. He wasn't arming Russia or the Nazis, but his crime was his antagonism towards the Nazis. And when Whitaker Chambers came to a member of the government, the U.S. government, to start the story that Alger Hiss was a communist, to discredit him, The man he arranged his conversation with was Assistant Secretary of State Adolph A. Burl, Jr., the same man that signed the papers for Mr. Maloxi, the business partner of Mr. Goering, to come to the United States. He manufactured weapons, guns, arms, Eastern Europe, a war criminal that should have been shot and kept there. And I repeat this because I want it to be clear. I don't want to brush over it. This man meets through Alan Dulles of the OSS, an agent, is brought to the United States. John Foster Dulles signs the papers for him to come here. Another man who co-signed it was Adolph Burl. Then, when Richard Nixon becomes famous in this case, it's Adolph Burl who also arranged the conversations with Whitaker Chambers that was to make Richard Nixon famous. Chambers stressed that when he went to Burl, and he also went to Isaac Don Levine, and he wanted to back out of his charges. He was getting weak, and he wasn't sure that he wanted to make these charges. And Isaac Don Levine was the man. This is a quote from Meyer Zelig's book. Burl hit upon Isaac Don Levine, who was a well-known journalist. Levine was a savvy. He would not blunder, and we arranged the meeting with Isaac Don Levine. Whitaker Chambers was fixed up with Isaac Don Levine, and Levine worked with Burl. From this book again, Levine met with Assistant Secretary of State Burl. That's the same man that signed the papers for Maloxi to come here, who was worked out of Nixon's law office. Having himself committed himself to Levine, Burl did. Whitaker Chambers worked with them. In September of 1939, Isaac Don Levine took a reluctant Whitaker Chambers, as Levine described it, by the arm to the home of Assistant Secretary of State Burl. And this is where they cooked up that communist story that Alger Hiss was a communist. Alger Hiss actually took a position of neutrality against the Nazis when the United States was talking about possibly arming again for another war, and they were concerned about Hitler. There was a Hitler-Stalin pact, and it was Alger Hiss who said we should not give arms to the Nazis. He didn't think we should give them to the Russians either. The rumor that Alger Hiss was a communist went throughout the Congress. This is what Meyer Zelig wrote. It all came from one single source. Whitaker Chambers went to Isaac Don Levine, who then went to Assistant Secretary of State Burl. This is from the book Friendship and Fratricide, the story of the tragedy of Alger Hiss. The whole story that Alger Hiss was a communist because he was an ardent anti-Nazi actually came from Whitaker Chambers, who went to Isaac Don Levine, who then went to Secretary of State Burl. And yet, Levine and Burl and Nixon and all of them were bringing in these Nazis. And anyone who was fighting the Nazis was called a communist. Even if they were pro-American, they were actually anti-Nazi, but they were pro-American. And good Americans like Alger Hiss went to jail or were discredited or lost their jobs or were blacklisted. Richard Nixon, as I say, entertained a gentleman in the White House who spoke there, who worked with this particular Maloxi. He passed himself off as a bishop, and you'll be reading a lot about these people. I think one of them is going to be deported, maybe 40 or 50 will be sent out. But there was a Dr. Joseph Paco, P-A-U-C-O, a Republican Party advisor, a pro-Nazi during World War II, who made speeches honoring the Nazis, who was an advisor of the Republican Party. I have a list of maybe 20 links of Richard Nixon to the Nazis of World War II. But the most outstanding story and the important book to buy and read it, because this young person, he's very young, Howard Bloom, did this research on this book on about these Nazis that came here, and he keeps stressing the importance of deporting them and exposing them. He wants 59 war criminals living in this country deported. And even though Mr. Maloxi is dead, Richard Nixon is alive. And I think somebody should confront Richard Nixon right now about his role of his law office, of Herman Perry, of a man, the vice president of Bank of America, being vice president of a dummy front that got money from the OSS and then went on to be the largest bank in the world. Something is wrong. And if you read about assassinations and germ flus and viruses and death squads and problems in this country, I maintain its origins came from these Nazis in this country, and they won't end until we smoke them out and expose them. time is up. Went pretty fast, didn't want to. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.